takeaways on that legacy of creating generational wealth? And what would be some inspiration for people who are hoping to get into the same position at some point?
I think it's so important, as we talked about earlier, is just not letting fear, you know, turning your fear and making it fuel and doing your research. Get out. If you want to get into the housing market, get out, do your research, see what's available, crunch the numbers, and then, you know, find partners. I mean, there are so many people that don't want the headaches of the management that could be potential investment partners. And then, you know, the equity will grow. I always say, you know, you can either be on the sidelines or get in the game, but either way, it's going to happen. And I've seen it time and time again.
I'll add some more points to that. I think I agree with everything you said. I would say that some of that fear that takes place, how do I get started? We found a best way to just get involved with people in our communities, even just talking to our bankers, to go and take them to lunch and have a conversation and say, hey, this is what I'm interested in. Here's how I plan to do it. What are your thoughts? How can I work to grow? And you'd be surprised what you can learn from a half hour, 45 minute lunch with someone like that. I would also say, if you're already in a position and you're thinking, how do I, you know, build that generational wealth, et cetera, looking at the third generation where I am right now, you know, when I graduated college, as we mentioned, I left town. You know, there was some conversations about, okay, well, what's really going to happen? And personally, I feel that I was blessed to be given that platform to go explore and learn on my own. But you have to be prepared to say, okay, how am I going to work this if my family members don't want to get involved? You know, what is my, you know, long-term planning look like? That goes back to the looking, you know, ahead. You have to be constantly planning.
I'd love to talk a little bit, Dana, about, you write a blog with your sister, Tracy. Yeah. And I was reading the blog, and there's a post of you with Taylor Swift's parents when she was in concert at Seattle. And I'm thinking, and we need to talk about it's not like you just fell into this. Your uncle is Quincy Jones, one of the most iconic leaders in the music industry ever. But I have to ask you, how did you get backstage with Taylor Swift's parents in Seattle?
You know, it's funny because my uncle had no connection with that one. That actually comes from my husband. I'm in a long distance marriage. My husband lives in Nashville and I'm in Seattle, and he's friends with Taylor Swift's dad. And so my son here is a Swiftie. He is the biggest Swiftie.
That's awesome, Brad.
Christmas, my husband got tickets for the concert, and we had no idea that we'd be sitting with Taylor Swift's mom and dad. And then when we're sitting in our seats, someone comes over and taps us, and they're like, are you ready for your COVID test? And we're like, huh? You know, we're out here in the stadium. What are you talking about? And then they took us backstage, and I got to tell you, it was quite the experience. It was amazing.
Wow. Talk about a family business. She's not doing too bad, is she?
I mean, her brother was there, mom, dad, they go to every show. I mean, it is truly a family production.
And some of the kindest people you will ever meet.
Yes.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. You look at business smarts and the fact that she now owns all of her music once again. And This current tour, she crossed the $1 billion mark in just tickets. And this was probably a couple months ago. And wow, it's just super neat to see some good people like that succeed. That's pretty cool. Let's talk about Uncle Quincy, though. I have to ask you, give me some background and some family stories. Quincy Jones, was he born in Seattle or just went to school in Seattle?
No, Margaret, I'll tell you that my parents, my mother's side of the family roots come from Chicago. And that's the other part of my family lineage that I'm so incredibly proud of, is that my grandfather was a carpenter. My grandmother was a lifelong domestic. And out of this little bitty two bedroom house, they raised eight individuals who all were incredible in every, I mean, my mom's baby brother is a federal judge. My aunt Margie, she was the first African-American flight attendant hired by Alaska Airlines and the first to retire. And, you know, all of my aunts and uncles are just phenomenal. And it was just instilled in them all to, you know, get busy. And my mother always shared stories of, you know, my Uncle Quincy, when all the other kids were out playing, you know, he was just locked in the community gym where there was a piano, and you know, that was his focus, and just laser focused on it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've been very fortunate to have a front row seat to people that are passionate about what they do and figure out a way to make it happen.
So any stories about Quincy just over the years in terms of, I mean, the guy's a genius, and some of the records that he's produced are some of the most iconic, successful, you know, records and songs in history. But do you have a story or two about Quincy that you'd like to share?
There's so many. First of all, he's one of the funniest people that I know. We always end a conversation with YOLO Coco. That is, you only live once, so keep on keeping on. He lives by the quote that the only place is in the dictionary that success comes before work. And, you know, he's just, you can't walk away from him without just feeling invigorated and just renewed. I mean, he's got that special gift that makes you know when you're in his presence that you are the only person that matters. And I'm on the board of Mopop, and last March we honored him for the Founders Award. And just going down the lane, even for myself, being raised with, you know, the old Smackwater Jack and, you know, the old albums, it was just such a timeline of history. It's even hard for me to mentally wrap my head around everything that he's accomplished.
Wow. Right. Brett, anything from you?
One quick story with Uncle Quincy is, I agree, you don't really, until you're with him in his presence and other people around him, relish the impact that he's made on so many people's lives in various ways. And as I mentioned, my grandfather passed away when I was very young. So I asked him, I said, Uncle Quincy, you know, tell me about my grandfather. I don't remember him that well. Like, what would you say? And he said, your grandfather was a hustler, you know, from day one. And I don't know if it's a bit of a backhanded compliment, but, you know, that's what got us here today is that hustling ability. And I think Uncle Quincy can relate to that as well.
Yeah.
Wow. That's such a rich family history. That's some amazing people that your grandparents, brought into the world and raised up. Dana, I'd love some perspective from you. Our country really over the past 5 years or so really has had a reckoning with race and our history and our history of racism in this country. I'd just love some thoughts from you, Dana, about where we are as a country in dealing with racism and where Seattle is more specifically when it comes to racism, because we've had to confront our past, and it's been a rocky period over the past several years in America. But I'd love to hear from you some thoughts on that.
Sure, Mark. I personally believe that we have a long way to go. One of the reasons that I decided to write my story is, you know, I was reading Emily Flitter's book called White Wall, and it talks about banking while Black. And in Emily's book, she shares how Jimmy Kennedy, who was a former NFL African-American star, he couldn't get private banking privileges. And they taped a conversation with an employee at Chase Bank and said, you know, we don't bank with people that look like you. And I mean, this is present day.
Wow.
And you know, he had $14 million and they would not give him private banking status. And, you know, it's an issue. I see it every day. I see it still when I try to get loans and, you know, the pushback, and they're not as desirable. And I mean, the statistics show that, you know, 74% of white households own homes compared to 46% of Black households. We've got to bring that divide smaller. We've got to bridge that deficit. And I think the only way that we're going to be able to do that is, as my son said, through education, through accessing funds and these programs that are available. They've got nationwide programs, not here in Seattle, but like Divvy Homes, that will help you do a lease with option to get into a house. Hmm. And equity is the only way to create the financial equity.
Yeah.
It's just, that's the only way we can do it. It's
still the oldest way, is that owning a home is just the equity that you build from that is how you start. And we have to work to, yeah, as Bob said, bridge that gap. We live in Seattle, which has one of the, it's a dwindling African-American population in this city. And you can trace that back to the last 60, 70 years from the redlining to when folks realized that the central district of Seattle was a great place because it's so close to everything. And so they drove prices up, different, you know, ethnicities came in here, and it forced a lot of African-American families either out, they sold their homes, they moved further south. And we're working hard to how do we course correct that now. But yeah, like my mom mentioned it again, we have to educate, we have to get involved in our communities, we have to speak up against these injustices.
And vote.
Yeah, and vote. Very important to get involved, both nationally and your local politics, you know, finding candidates that are really supportive of your vision and position.